So I came across this meme the other day that said this. I lost my car chapstick, and now my backpack chapstick is in my bathroom, and my bathroom chapstick is in my car, and my whole life is just messed up. My whole life is just messed up. What do you do when your whole life just gets messed up? Now, obviously, you know, aside from, you know, the silly little things, but, like, what about, like, the big things? Like, when things really get messed up and to the point where it's like, you know, there's something to do, but you have no idea what to do. Like, what do you do when you don't know what to do when it comes to the big decisions or a big diagnosis, perhaps, or just the difficulties that come up? Like, what is it that we do when we absolutely feel frozen and have no idea what to do? Well, I want to invite you to turn to the book of Exodus this morning that talks really a whole lot about that. As if you're newer with us, we are actually on a journey from cover to cover throughout the entire scriptures. And so Exodus is just the second book in the Bible, so you're not far behind and you can easily catch up. You can just go to firstdecatur.org and find out how to catch up on the messages, or if you want to jump in on our reading plan. But essentially, just to kind of get us all caught up, we've been looking at the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, which could be summed up in four events and four people. Namely, the four events in Genesis 1 through 11 is the formation, the creation of the world, and then from there, kind of the fall, or as we've said, the take, where Adam and Eve took from God the ability to discern good and evil by eating from the knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then God pushes reset with a flood on the entire world, but then they take that second chance humanity at the Tower of Babel and try to replace God. So you've got these four events. And then from there, the majority of the bandwidth of Genesis are these four individuals. This promise that God is going to bless the entire world through this man's lineage. Abraham, then Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph and his brothers would one day come the promised Messiah. And we noticed that the bandwidth was a little off from these pretty significant events to just these four guys and their wives. But what we were reminded of is that when it comes to what God is ultimately about, that he's not primarily about events, but he's about people, and namely his relationship to us as his people. And so if you wanted to sum up the book of Genesis even more briefly than that, you could say that with the fallout and all the things, and we watched as these guys kind of stumbled and fall along the way, that if Genesis is the story of humanity's failure, well, then you could say Exodus is God rushing to our rescue. God rushing to our rescue. So that's what we're going to discover today, starting in Exodus chapter 1. And as we work our way cover to cover, Exodus has got a lot in it, so we're going to try to cover a lot in a little bit of time. And I risk talking fast as it is, so we'll see how this goes. Exodus chapter 1, starting in verse 6. It says, "Now Joseph," which was the last of those characters that we looked at, "and all his brothers," that whole generation, "they died off. But the Israelites, they were exceedingly fruitful, and they multiplied greatly. They increased in numbers and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. But then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt." You ever been in one of those settings where it's like you've been working for a place for a while, you kind of had the old boss, the old way of doing things, and everything was just fine, and then, you know, got bought out, or a new boss and a new way of doing things? It's just not quite the same. Yeah, this is definitely what happens for Israel here. As the new boss comes in and says, "Look," he said to his people, "these Israelites, they have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us and then leave the country." And so, conservatively, they're about 2 million now in population. Out of the Abraham of, or the lineage of Abraham, we have now got about approximately 2 million. And so you could say that as their population increased, their popularity decreased. Verse 11. "And so the Egyptians, they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites." And so we see this kind of inverse relationship, that the more they try to oppress the Israelites, the more they multiply, the more they grow. And so Pharaoh, realizing he can't, you know, kind of keep them down by oppressing them, he seeks out to eliminate them by issuing an edict that the firstborn boy of every Hebrew family, every Israelite family, is to be thrown into the Nile. And so for this is obviously pure evil, pure genocide, where the stakes could not be higher, where Pharaoh, if he succeeds in putting an end to the people of God, well, then he would succeed in putting an end to the story of God because of this promise, this lineage that's supposed to be coming through Abraham's lineage, okay? And so, again, God shifts his attention now, we see from these events, to his people. And very specifically, a person among those people, a person by the name of Moses. We see the story of Moses, if you're familiar with him, throughout the book of Exodus. So Moses' story starts off as one of these baby Hebrew boys. And so he's got basically a death sentence right out of the gate. And so his mother, naturally, as a mother's going to do everything he can to protect, protect her little baby, she hides him for about 3 months until the scriptures say that she could hide him no longer. She could no longer keep him a secret. And so what she does is she weaves this basket together with pitch and tar and papyrus, really symbolically, theologians say, as almost like a second Noah's Ark for care and protection of her little baby. And she literally, she is John Bon Joving it. She's living on a prayer. She scoots that little basket across the water into the reeds among the bank of the Nile. When, at that moment, the daughter of the same Pharaoh who has ordered the destruction of these Hebrew babies, this daughter, she sees among the reeds the basket, sees the baby crying, and unlike her wicked Pharaoh father, she has compassion on the child. And Pharaoh's daughter goes to her dad, and she does what daughters do. Daddy, can I keep him? I will feed him and water him. I'll take him for walks. I'll clean up after him. Please, please, Daddy, can I keep him? To which he allows it. He allows her to keep the child, to which then she promptly puts out a help wanted sign to get someone to come and nurse and care for the baby. And wouldn't you have it, the individual, the woman they end up hiring, is none other than actual, not even knowing it, Moses' own mother. Which, how incredible is this? Chapter 2, verse 9. It says, Pharaoh's daughter said to Moses' mother, not realizing it's even her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. I mean, think about the providence of God for Moses and his mother at this moment. And so the woman, Moses' mother, took the baby and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. And so you have Moses, though ethnically Hebrew, ethnically Jewish, he's raised as an Egyptian. And so he gets like the funky eyeliner. He starts listening to the Bangles, starts walking like an Egyptian and talking like an Egyptian. It's full-on dad joke day today. Just want you to know what you signed up for. And so Moses, he grows up really under the best of the best, the best education. This is lifestyles of the rich and famous for Moses in Egypt. In fact, it's understood that Pharaoh, that particular Pharaoh, had no natural born sons and only daughters. And so you could have expected that this particular Moses would have actually been then next in line for the throne of Egypt. You think about the reality of what that could have meant. But verse 11, it says, one day, after Moses had grown up, he's 40 years old at this point, he went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. And looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and he saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, he said, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? To which the man said, who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? When Moses heard this, he was afraid and thought, what I have done must have become known. And when Pharaoh heard this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses, he fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. And so you have, in literally mere moments, everything changes. And we know that. When it comes to those situations where we don't know what to do because we don't know what to do, it's amazing how just a phone call, a conversation, a mere moment can change everything. If you think about it, for Moses, he was, in a moment, next in line potentially to be Pharaoh, and now, in an instant, he's a fugitive on the run. And so he flees to Midian, and while in Midian, there he finds a wife, and then just begins a lowly job working for his father-in-law as a herder of sheep, which he does for the next 40 years of his life. This is the second 40. So you think about this life trajectory. He spends the first 40 years, you know, really thinking he's something, you know, a big shot in Egypt, to the next 40 is essentially a nothing over in Egypt, just taking care of sheep, working for his father-in-law. But the scriptures say at that time, during that time, during that long period, that Pharaoh, that king of Egypt, died. And so the old Pharaoh is gone. They have found a new Pharaoh to take his place. However, the same slavery and the same suffering continue. And so it says that the Israelites, they groaned in their slavery and they cried out. They cried out to God for help because of their slavery, and it went up to God. And God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And so God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. What an important reminder. Like for you, and that whatever it is that you don't know what to do, like however long it feels like it's been going on, or however long it's actually been going on, just this reminder that God, he hears us, that he has concern and compassion for his people. And so, meanwhile, back in Midian, Exodus chapter 3, verse 2. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight. And you think about it, for Moses, like he's not seen the show Stranger Things. Like he doesn't know what's supposed to happen next. I mean, he's just seen this strange thing. And so he goes over and he says, why does this bush not burn up? To which God called him from the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And at this Moses, he hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. To which this high call, if you know the story, Moses, he responds, yes, sir. And he puts on his Iron Man mask and he straps those boots and he blasts off to save the Israelites. That's actually, you know, that's not what happened. No, that is not what he did. He did not jump to God's call. Actually, quite the opposite. You know, Moses at this moment, Moses got questions. He's got excuses. He's got reasons. He's got this, you know, kind of thanks, but even no thanks kind of attitude towards God as we see it. And so Moses starts to dialogue with God at this powerful moment. He kind of brings it down. He says, pardon your servant, you know, trying to be all polite. Pardon your servant, but like, what if they don't listen to me? Or pardon your servant again. What about the fact that I stutter? That I don't like talk good and stuff. Like that's what Moses is trying to argue with God about. And I love that Moses is trying to be polite. Like the whole like pardon your servant, but. And I know what this is like. Growing up in the South, when I grew up in South Carolina, when I would say something stupid as a middle school kid in class, if my seventh grade teacher, Mrs. Bell, looked at me and said, bless your heart. As polite as that may have sounded, the next thing that's going to come out of her mouth is not kindness at all. It usually goes something like this. Brian, I have a two-syllable name, but in the South, it's down to one syllable. Brian, bless your heart. That makes about as much sense as a milk bucket under a bowl. Just give it a second. You'll get there. And so that's what Moses is trying to do. He's trying to be polite. He's trying to, you know, pardon your servant, but it's just full of but this and but that. And so finally, you could say the real reason comes out. And isn't that how it goes? It's like you've got a reason, then there's the reason, then there's like the real reason. To which Moses finally just responds in Exodus chapter 4, verse 13, as it says, "But Moses said, 'Pardon your servant, Lord. Please just send someone else. Just send someone else. Do not make me do this.'" And understandably so. Going up to stand up against the Pharaoh, the king of a nation, is no small thing. Nevertheless, despite Moses angling his excuses, his, you know, trying to do everything he can to find an exit strategy out of this call of God, as we've seen so far, working our way from cover to cover, that despite, you could say, throughout already our short history through the book of the Bible, many man's attempts to spoil God's plan, we keep seeing. It's God's plan, it's his purpose, his promise that is going to continue to prevail. And so that's exactly what happens. As God takes this guy who, again, for 40 years thought he was a big shot something over in Egypt, a nothing now over in Midian, and now can in finally his final 40 years, like his third trimester of life, he's going to take this nothing so that God can do something significant through him. And we think about that. Like, I mean, this is... He encounters God at the burning bush at the age of 80, and his real ministry, his real calling, his purpose on the planet is going to shake out from age 80 to 120. And the reason I love this little nuance within the story is because I think we miss the reality that it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how old you are, whether you feel like you've been a something your whole life or a nothing your whole life. It is never too late for God to call upon you to do something significant through you. I got to tell you, that's why we're committed. And if you've been with us, you know that we have, as part of our Whatever It Takes initiatives, a commitment to ensure that there is an expression of the church in every single one of our assisted living center and senior centers in our community, because we know that God's not done yet. In fact, we've seen this play out. One of my favorite stories is a friend of mine by the name of Ron. Co-lead one of these kind of church services at one of the assisted living centers here in the community. And I remember his very first week there. And his exact words were, "I feel like I've been put here to die." And for him to be able, kind of through our time together, to take what he felt like was a death sentence for himself and actually turn that into a decision for Jesus was a remarkable thing. He committed his life to Jesus. We got to baptize him here in our church. And then he went back to his senior center, really understanding like himself like a missionary being sent back in. And we used to joke, we called him the mayor, because he literally walked to every single table at every single meal to check in, to make sure everybody's okay, everything's copacetic, everything okay with the ice cream sandwiches. Okay, all right. But beneath all that, he really was a chaplain. He was a chaplain taking care of the people who were in front of him. In fact, I got to sit with him in one of his friend's room, a guy by the name of Paul, when he gave his life to Christ because of the ministry that, not me, but Ron was a part of. You can't make this stuff up. It is never too late for God to do something significant through you, no matter what you feel like your story up to this date has been. Because when God calls you from the bush, God's going to make his plans and his purposes prevail if we obey. Okay, and so that's what we see with Moses. Moses does this, but even as we share this, even as we share Moses, again, the reminder of the story, even though God uses us, it's not about us. It's about God. It's about what God is up to. And so we see this play out. In fact, I love the way in which God clarifies this for Moses. One of his excuses amidst his litany of them, he says this to God. He says, "Hey, well, when I go to Egypt," because there were no atheists in Egypt. Essentially, they had a god for everything. And so when I go amongst all these gods, which god do I say sent me? To which I love what God responds. He says, "You tell them, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." Isn't that like such a mic drop moment and move of God? Like, you want to boil down who I am? I am. Like, I am, like period. Like, that's who God says he is. There is only, because there is only one God, and that is the point he's going to make. We're going to see as he comes, he
goes and there's going to be these plagues that come. And every single one of these plagues is actually a declaration against a false god in Egypt. If you start reading through those, the frogs and the locusts and the gnats and the lice, it's like, ooh, you know, it's just like, what are these things? This is speaking against and showing the power of the one true God against these false gods all throughout Egypt. So anyway, Moses, he goes and he says, hey, I am, says, you got to let my people go, to which the Pharaoh says, no, so God sends those 10 plagues, of which the 10th plague is the most difficult of them all. As God says in Exodus chapter 11, verse 6, about this 10th plague, he says that there will be such loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there ever has been or ever will be again. And so what could be so awful? What could be so difficult? Well, in the sovereignty and in the justice of God in this moment, that after the previous Pharaoh demanded all the Hebrew baby boys be thrown into the Nile, God strikes down the firstborn boy of every Egyptian, including Pharaoh's oldest son, the new Pharaoh, to which Pharaoh's had enough. He can't take it anymore, and he sends the Israelites away, to which his continued hardened heart, as you see throughout the story, he then changes his mind and pursues after them, as it says. It says, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials, they changed their minds about them, and they said, what have we done? We have let the Israelites go, and we have lost their services. Verse 10, and so as Pharaoh approached, the Israelites, they looked up. And just kind of as an aside, when they look up, the first thing they see is the Red Sea in front of them. And as they look up behind, they see this Egypt that they thought they had left behind chasing after them in the form of an army. As the Egyptians were marching after them, it says, and they were terrified. They were terrified, and they naturally, they cried out. They cried out to the Lord. Which really brings us back to that initial question that we asked. Like, what do we do when we don't know what to do? Again, not the little things, but like the big decisions, the big diagnosis, the big difficulties. What do we do when we don't know what to do, when we're insecure and we're unsure and we're afraid, and if we're honest, we're just flat terrified? Like, what do we do when we don't know what to do? Like for you, maybe you're in a season where it's like technically you have a job, but you start hearing things and the writing on the wall, and you're knowing with a matter of weeks or months, like this could look very different, and you don't know what to do. Or maybe you fill in the blank. It's the recent diagnosis of your dad, or the diagnosis of your grandma, or just like just this past week, a good friend of mine, Mike, the diagnosis of his daughter. Maybe for you, it's your diagnosis, like, and you're thinking, like, if this does not work out in healing this side of heaven, like, how does this play out for us? Or maybe you're in one of those seasons of marriage where nothing seems to add up. Communication seems like a total waste of time because communication isn't happening. You're talking past each other. You just can't seem to get on the same page. It's so confusing and upside down. And you realize, like, the stakes of this not working out are so high, and it's like the more you try, the worse it gets, and it's like, I don't know what to do. What do you do when you for real do not know what to do? When you look up and you see a Red Sea in front of you and an army now chasing behind, kind of when it rains, it pours, or it comes in threes. We have all these sayings around when things just go all over the place. Like, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Well, a lot of us, we cry out. We cry out specifically to God, maybe. Sometimes we kind of cry out almost against those who we're trying to work with to make it happen. We almost turn on those who we thought we were working together with to kind of solve the thing that we were, because it's all a mess. So it happens with the Israelites. They actually turn on Moses. They turn on the very one who God used to rescue them from this 400 years of slavery. Listen how this goes. They turn on Moses. They say to Moses, with just a hint of sarcasm, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to this desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out to Egypt? Hey, didn't we say in Egypt, leave us alone. Let us serve the Egyptians. it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. And even though, and you know this, like, they didn't actually say those things back in Egypt, I think Moses, rather than get defensive, start saying, no, that's not what you said, and, you know, kind of, you know, get some sort of email war with them or something, or social media battle. Like, he doesn't do that. He doesn't give in to the criticism and the critiques, because I think he gets it. I think he understands that amidst their complaints and the criticism that they're just scared. They're terrified. He knows that they're in a spot where they have no idea what to do, and they don't know what to do because they don't know what to do. They were afraid. They were terrified, it says. And so verse 13, Moses, he answers. Here is what you do when you don't know what to do. Moses answers the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. You need only to be still. You know, I wonder, like, how Moses said that. Like his tone. Like, I don't think it was like a kind of a quiet counseling session. Like, hey, guys, just be still. It's going to be okay. You know, Lord, he's going to fight for you. I would anticipate it was probably more of like a halftime pep talk. Like, hey, guys, be still. The Lord will fight for you. Like, I know your marriage is on the ropes. I know you don't know what to do. And I realize that the more you keep trying, the worse it keeps trying to get. Like, be still. You need to let the Lord fight for you on this one. Or that uncertainty around your job situation, the worry about what could happen and the things that haven't happened but could happen. So you start worrying about the mortgage payment that's 3 months away because what could possibly happen, and that energy is wearing off on you and on your spouse and on your kids, and there's just kind of this, it's just, be still. The Lord will fight for you. Or when you just, every single one of us, when we turn on anything news-related and we look around at all the political divisiveness and the wondering and the worrying about where our country's going to head over the course of the next number of months, and we kind of boil that down right back to our community, and we're all kind of frazzled and spinning and spazzing. It's just like, be still and trust that the Lord will fight for you. And I got to be honest. I'm enough of a cynic to know that even as you hear that, you're like, and so as helpful as you may or may not think that this is, see what happens in the next verse. It says in verse 15 that after Moses tells the people to be still, that the Lord responds to the people and says to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Other translations say to move forward or to keep moving. So let me get this straight. Moses is saying, be still. But God is saying, what are you sitting still for? Like get moving, like keep moving forward. Like, what are we trying to accomplish here? It's the reality that these actually aren't an either-or proposition. But it's actually a both-and. It's a both-and. It's where, you know, you see the Red Sea, because that's what they're going to say. It's like, okay, like keep moving. Like God, there is kind of that, like, this, the Red Sea, like, it's right there. Like, what do you mean keep moving? Keep moving. Be still and move on. Because this is what belief is. This is what faith is. Faith is the ability to be still in the confidence of the Lord while still putting one foot in front of the other. And I got to tell you, like, as I think and kind of dwell on this, like, as I think about every scary season of my life, like, yes, this is it. It is this quiet confidence that God's got this, but at the same time, still moving forward in faith. That's actually what faith is. That's what we sang earlier, that the battle belongs to the Lord. This is how I fight my battles. In fact, if you were with us last week, we defined in the original languages what faith and belief is. It's this Greek word in the New Testament, pistuo, which means to trust, to have faith, to believe to the extent of complete trust, to entrust, to put something into the care of another. It's the ability to be still in our spirit while still taking steps forward with our feet. It's a paradox that works perfectly together. And this is what we see take place for Israel. Next verse, verse 16. It says, and then the Lord said to Moses, this is how you do it. Raise your staff, stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. That in faith, they trust him and one foot in front of the other, they move forward on the path that God makes possible. Verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and a wall of water on their left. And you're like, I've got questions about how that worked. Go back to Genesis 1 and 2. If he can create it, he can move it, okay? Moving on. That day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians. And so look, I don't know what your Egypt is. And at just the moment that maybe you thought you got from like underneath it, bless your heart, there it is, chasing you from behind, as well as worse yet, seeing a Red Sea in front of you. And so when it all comes down to it, and we put our faith and our belief in God, what is it, kind of holistically, that we, in fairness, are actually putting our faith in? What are we actually trusting in? Like, what's the substance of that? Well, interesting, we actually discover that back in that 10th and final plague. That as we go back to Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, this is how that 10th plague of striking down the firstborn in Egypt plays out. God says, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. If you are a firstborn here in the room this morning or a firstborn in the East Auditorium, would you stand with me? If you are the oldest child in your household, in both rooms, I'm one as well, so I'm right here with you. To the Israelites, God said, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household, and then take some of the blood and put it on the sides and the tops of the door frames of the house. And what's super important about this is I think we read this and we think, oh, the Israelites are innocent and Egypt is guilty. No. They're all guilty. We are all guilty. As it later says in Romans, that we have all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And the wages, the penalty, the reality of that sin is death for us all. And so with this in mind, would all of you please stand up here in the West Auditorium as well as in the East Auditorium. Exodus 12, verse 13, God says, the blood will be a sign for you on the houses that where you are, that when I see the blood, I will pass over you and no destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is Passover, the celebration of Passover, which Jews and Christians alike around the world celebrate here actually this particular week. And you could say that was, yes, then for Israel, but now for the whole world. Like that was the Old Testament, and now in the New Testament, that was the first Passover, but now for the new Passover, Jesus Christ. John chapter 1, verse 29, John the Baptist says, "Behold, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. For Christ, our Passover Lamb." Christ, our Passover Lamb, he has been sacrificed, it says later, once and for all, because in him we have redemption. Through what? Through his blood. Through his blood for the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace. That this is what our faith is. This is what our belief is, and this is the firm foundation that whatever is the Egypt that's behind you or the army that is chasing you or the Red Sea in front of you, this is where we be still and we keep moving forward by our faith in Jesus and what he has done. And so again, I don't know what your Egypt is or that army chasing you from behind, but one of the ways that God gives us an ability to both kind of be still and move forward at the same time, as weird as it might sound, is actually through worship. When we don't know what to say and we have these songs that give us the words to say, God, we're gonna put our trust, our belief in you so that when we go from this place in the other 167 hours outside of this 1 hour gathered together, we will be able to move forward in the faith and the stillness of that Psalm 56:10, that we would be still and know that I'm God even as we move forward. And so as we sing this song, let it be the words that represent the prayers and the needs and the requests on your heart, whether on your behalf or someone else. That whatever your Egypt is, may you in this moment, we pray, God, be still, and may we also move forward in faith, trusting you. In the name of Jesus, we proclaim with our voices as we sing together. Amen.